In the last week or two, we've been discussing the Das, inner knowledge. Now, the next step is to understand an aspect of that which is very difficult. If the last week's subject was difficult, it is more difficult, because this is a part of the spectrum of the Das, that inner wisdom which we tried to discuss a little bit last week, that one can't find words to explain. This is the part of the Das that's hidden. That means if you could see that, which you can't see, then if you could see it, then it would have two parts, the revealed part and the hidden part. We now want to look at the part of it that's hidden. So we're looking at the hidden in the hidden now. But again, it's not impossible. That means we have a natural ability to abstract into that place, and we could feel and relate to what it is. And the way to get to it is to discuss a certain subject, and that is tefillah, davening. The idea of prayer, praying, davening. It will take us into this area. You can feel right away that the problem, what it means davening, is to pray, it's a very difficult area to understand from any point of view. The whole experience is a strange one. You're standing speaking to somebody, you don't hear that, you don't get it, you don't feel that you listen to, that you heard. You want to say the same words over and over 3 times a day. More amazing things are dependent on davening. Do we feel it? Do we see it? And it's a very difficult experience, and it's probably the most important thing there is. It's not optional. Davening as a part of the spiritual world is not like an optional extra. It says that existence depends on it. A person's ongoing existence depends on how much they ask for. And if they don't ask, they don't get. And if they ask, they get exactly as much as they ask for. If you don't ask, you don't get. You may continue for a while in the world just degenerating on till the end, but that's not called being alive. So let's try and understand one or two things that are at the root of this experience of tefillah, of davening, and try and see where it takes us in the hidden world. Let's start like this. Let's start by looking at some of the problems. We won't have time, I don't think, to come back and try and tie up each problem, but we'll try and explain the issue enough that anybody who's thinking will be able to go back to these issues and see how they all work out from the theme and the idea that we try and bring out. The problems with davening are many. Okay. First of all, what has davening got to do with the rain? If you look, you'll see that a central idea in tefillah, in davening, is connected to rain. What does this mean? Why that specially? Why in Hebrew is the rain, the word for geshem, the word for rain in Hebrew is geshem? Anybody who has a smattering of Hebrew knows that geshem doesn't only mean rain, it means all of material existence. Gashmi, gashmiut, right? Geshem means anything of material existence. The rain is only, it's only one of the meanings of that word. The root meaning of geshem is actually the whole of physicality, the whole of the created world, right? Gush means a body, a mass. Geshem means anything physical, not only the rain. We know that no two words are connected in Hebrew accidentally. So the same word applies to two things, and has to have a very, very, has to be that the two things are the same thing. Why is the whole of physicality referred to by the same word as the rain? Why is that specially connected to davening? You see amazing things about it. There was a man called Chone Amargel. He drew a circle during a time of drought. He drew a circle on the ground and he said, Hashem, I'm not leaving this circle until it rains. So that's what the Gemara. I think what happened was it started to rain, to drizzle. He said, that's not what I meant. Then it started to flood. He said, that's too much. Then it started to rain normally and properly, and he left. Now, that's a lot of power involved. Today we don't have. Today our davening on a vow that it should achieve anything that we could see. Actually, there's a promise that everything you say in davening is answered. Complete and utter promise. You have to be sensitive to how it's answered, but if you are sensitive, you definitely see it. Let's take a time to try and discuss that also. First, let's try and get to the root of it. There's also a text that's brought in Chazal of a man who, it says he went down to Davin They used to say, the expression in the Gemara is always down, because they used to all have it done from a low place. It says, Nimam Akim Karasifa, I've called to you from the depth. So in Zaloka, they had a, in a shul, there are, in those days the shuls used to have a place where the Shnei Chatzim were davened up in front with a hole in the ground. To step down into a pit in order to daven, it was lower than the rest of the ground. And Zaloka, that it shouldn't be higher. So they called from a low place. It says that, I think it says, Shalif Chad Misane. He just took off one of his shoes and it started raining. But what the idea of shoes connected to the body and why shoes are taken off in davening, that's not tonight's subject. But it says that he hadn't even begun yet to say the words. He just chalat echad min alav. He took off one of his shoes and already started to rain. To fulfill what it says, that before you even call, I'll answer you. But you have to make the effort to call. What's all this mean? That's problem area number one. Problem area number two is this, that we always look in Torah at the words. We always look at the letters and the words to see what the thing means. The word tefillah, davening, is a very strange word in Hebrew. Very, very strange word, because it means two opposites. That means two concepts that are exactly opposed to each other, and they're contained in the same word. Huh? What are those ideas? The one concept is the concept of requesting something that you don't deserve and couldn't even hope to have. That means an outpouring of desire to have something that you don't even feel that you have a right or even any connection with that thing. You know? Like it says, Re'os panecha lo pilalti. When Yaakov saw Yosef, his son, after 22 years of not seeing him, he said, I never hoped to see your face again. I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I would ever see you again. He thought he wasn't alive. To use the word pilalti, that means an expression of the root of tefillah is the root in Hebrew palal. That's palal, that root. And that root means an inexpressible hope. It means a hope of something that I never could even hope to see such a thing. That means that aspect of tefillah means that when a person is davening, they are asking for something that's so beyond our level that it's almost impossible even to ask for it, like even to hope for that thing. It's completely outside the system. That means you don't deserve it at all. It's completely disconnected to where you are, and yet you're asking for it. That's why it's always called Bayi Rachmeh. In the Gemara it always says Bayi Rachmeh. That means he asks for Rachmeh, he asks for mercy. And that root of davening, that root of the word in Hebrew always means to ask for mercy. Mercy means that which you don't deserve. What you deserve is called din. That's judgment. You did something wrong, you deserve this. You're in a certain spiritual situation, you deserve this and this and this kind of handout. And nothing more, nothing less. But rachamim means, it's like a mother's womb. The word rachamim, the root of the word is rechem. Right? It means to give birth to something. His birth where there wasn't life before. You rearrange the letters of rechem, the womb, it's spelled machar, tomorrow. That means it gives you a future. The womb is a place that the future is a beautiful thing there. Right? Those letters, machar, tomorrow, and rechem, the same letters. And if you rearrange them a third way, you get ramach, which is the 248 organs and limbs that come out of the womb, at the parts of the body. But be that as it may, one of the central meanings of that word is tomorrow, which is the concept of rachamim, you get a future. The concept of din is you have no future. If you make a misstep, you finished immediately. That's din. Rachamim means you get an extension, you get a future, you have a future to look forward to. So davening by rachamim means he asked for mercy. It means he asked for an extension, he asked for life that he didn't deserve. That's the concept. So that aspect of tefillah means a person asking, this is only not connected to Jews, by the way. This is aspect of all humans, not only specific to Jews. Special dimension of davening that a non-Jew has also through the temple. That's a very special thing. But it's a human experience to ask for something that's beyond the system entirely, beyond what you are. But the word has exactly the opposite meaning also. Because the word plili in Hebrew, anybody knows any Hebrew knows, the word halal also has a root, the same root meaning, the English word would be something like something avon plili in Hebrew, they translate as a felony. That means a criminal act that is so, it's a felony, that means it's a grand crime. It's something that you follow, that implies the strictest justice. That's what the root plili means. It means negotiation to the point where exactly what's deserved is given. But that's exactly the opposite of the first meaning. You with me? And they're both contained in the same root of that of tefillah. You hear the problem? I mean, you have a Hebrew word that means two opposite things. It means they can't be opposites. It means they both have to be the same thing. But how can that be? How can that be? The root also means not only justice, but it means a negotiated justice. It means, I'll give you an example. It says that when Pinchas arose to defend the honor of Hashem, there was a terrible act of immorality in the Jewish camp in the desert. And Pinchas arose to avenge Hashem's honor. And as he stood up, it uses the word plili again. I think it says, Vayipalel Pinchas, I think it says in the passage, that he did this thing. But a simple meaning would mean he doesn't. He was going to do an act that put his life in danger, because it says the men of Shimon were standing around where this act was taking place, and anybody who tried to go in to stop what was happening, a man was committing an act of immorality with a woman from a non-Jewish, one of the non-Jewish nations, and Pinchas went in and killed him to avenge Hashem's honor. But anybody who would try and enter that tent where the two of them were would be killed immediately by the guards of the tribe who were standing around, and he had to risk his life and go ahead and do it. So it says he got up and he did this thing. The Poshim say that what he did was he negotiated, he made a deal with Hashem. He made a deal. He started negotiating with Hashem. Which means that in the language of Tefillah is also the concept of negotiating. That means you stand up and you make a deal. And if you look in the words of the Tefillah, you'll see we do that all the time. Before we start, the first thing we say in the morning before we start the Sukkah Zimra, we start Mizmor Shir Chanukah Habayit. If you look in there, you'll see it says, Ma Besa Bedami Beriziti El Shachar. You say to Hashem the following incredible words. Ma betza bedomi. That means, what profit do you have in my blood if I die? That's what you say to Hashem. You say, listen Hashem, then worth it to you. That's how you start off the davening. And before you start the davening, you stand and you say one mizmor to Tehillim. Which one do you choose? The one that has the words in it. Listen Hashem, I'll show you why it's not worth your while to take me out of the world. I'll prove it to you. You're telling him? You're telling him what's worthwhile in his world and what's not? That's what you do. So the Jew does. I mean, that's what we talk about chutzpah. You get up there and you say, Hashem, ma betza bedomi. Betza means profit. Means profit. Betza means a profit on a business deal. You say to him, Ma betza bedomi, what profit do you have in my blood? Beridisi el shachas, if I go down to the grave. Why? Hayedcha offer. Will the dust praise you? Hayagid amitecha, will the dead in Sheol, in the pit, in the grave, will they praise you? So what do you want it for, Hashem? If you kill me, I can't serve you anymore. I can't praise you. I can't. So keep me here. It's a much better deal for you. That's what it is. That's what a Jew does. So what's this got to do with davening? And the whole concept of this negotiating, that it's not worth it to you, Hashem, to take me out of the picture, it's a much better deal for you to keep me around, that's contained in the word tefillah. Yes? Now how do you have the chutzpah to do such a thing? Now don't stand up before the king and start negotiating, explaining to him why it's more logical for him to put up with you than not. And he knows what. Where does that come from? What does that mean? You see, it's a difficult subject, davening. Not a simple thing. Not a simple thing at all. To get up three times a day and spit out some words, that's not davening. It takes much, much more depth than that. Right? It's the highest act of meditation. That's where meditation is in Judaism. Thirdly, this second idea leads us to a third area of making deals and negotiating, leads us to an even more difficult question, and this is the central question behind the idea of davening. And anybody who has ever thought about anything should have thought about this question. And the question is as follows. The idea of davening is requesting things. If you look at the Shemona Esrei, that's a central part of our tefillah, of our davening. You're asking for something. Boy, Rachmeh, like we said before, you're asking for mercy, for kindness, for an extension, for life. But the 19 blessings that you go through, which are all requests. Well, the first three and the last three are not requests, so that's the time to deal with it separately. There's first of all three that you start what's called Mesada Shvacha Shel Makom. That means you organize the praises of Hashem. It's like coming before the king. First you say a certain form of praise, and to discuss what that means and why. And then there's three brachas at the end of praise. As you bow out and you retreat, you end off on a note of thanks for everything. Thanks for having been listened to. Thanks for what you've got already. Thanks for being able to thank even. Moedim al she'anachnu moedim. So it starts off with an introduction of worship or of praise, if you like, and it finishes with an expression of thanks. But in between, sandwiched between those two ideas, we'll have to try and explain if we get time, how that introduction and that ending are actually connected to the same thing, because davening is actually one and the same, all one experience. In between, the body of the davening consists of requests. You're asking for something. Yeah? What's that got to do with meditation? Requesting things, and you ask for the same things always. What does that mean? And furthermore, there's a more difficult issue as follows. By the way, you know that no one's exempt from this, like I said before. Women have to daven also. Now, according to most of the Rishonim, that's a mitzvah, and according to men, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa. That means a mitzvah of the Torah, even though women are exempt from time bound mitzvahs. There's a seat over here, please. You might feel comfortable to say. Maybe somebody could give me a seat. There's a concept that women are exempt from time-bound mitzvahs that are positive mitzvahs. But davening, according to most authorities, women have to do. Even if it's only a minute a day, doesn't necessarily have to daven the whole of Shacharis or the whole of Minchah or even the whole Shemoneh Esrei. But according to most authorities, at least a few minutes a day, right, of saying something, saying words, of making a connection. At least that. And it's well known that until the last generation, that we're an orphan generation, we never saw this. But until the last generation, at least, Every Jewish woman had a Tehillim, a book of Tehillim that was stained with her tears. Now the tears soaked Tehillim that she poured her heart out over. She wouldn't miss a day without saying the Tehillim of that day and pouring out her heart in request for what she needed and what she wanted in life. Right? That her children should turn out correctly, their marriage should be what it should be, that there should be kedusha in her life. That's what a Jewish woman was. And a woman can possibly feel that more deeply than a man. But that's what tefillah was. Now, this experience of davening has attached to it the following enormous question, and it's as follows. This idea of requesting things, if you think about it for a minute, you'll see it means this. I stand up and I say to him, look, I want this and this and this. Okay, I need. I need this and this and this, and you list your whole, you list it all, everything. You go to the 19 book and it doesn't leave out anything, right? You list the request for intelligence, for understanding, for bina, for das. The first bracha is the bracha for das. What we've been talking about the last weeks of inner understanding, that's a gift from above. It starts at a level beyond where we start. Not things you can work out or train. It's a thing that has to be given as a gift. That's the first bracha that you ask. So you ask for that. You ask for help. You ask for luck. You ask for financial, for kanus. You ask for everything. Almost half the brachas, close to half the brachas, are davening for the messianic revelation. For the final revelation, right? For spiritual transcendence. And you ask for everything. Right? The question is this. What thought is there in the mind of a person who is asking Hashem for things and explaining to Hashem that he needs something? Then the concept is that Hashem knows everything. So he knows what you need. You don't have to tell him what you need in order for him to understand what you need. Right? It's an axiom of our fundamental, what we understand that Hashem is that he knows everything there is to know. So what are you trying to explain to him? Right? Not only does he know what you need, but we have an understanding that he's a loving father. The concept of a loving father, that he gives a child what he needs without the child having to ask. What father hands out to his son only when the kid's starving and comes and begs? Doesn't do that. The father sees, and the mother sees the need of the child, and the parent gives the child what he needs. Doesn't have to ask. So if Hashem's a loving father, he's going to give you what you need without you asking for it. And furthermore, if you don't deserve it, and it's not good for you, he won't give it to you even if you do ask. The child who asks his father for something that's dangerous. So no matter how much he asks his father, he's not going to be given it because it's bad for him. So what do you hope to achieve by telling Hashem what you need? You're not telling him any news. He knows beforehand what it is that you need. And if you need it genuinely, he's going to give it to you. If you deserve it and need it and could use it and it's good for you, he's not going to withhold it from you. That's what he's there for. On the other hand, if you don't deserve it, then it's not good for you. He's not going to give it to you even if you ask him. So what is this futile kind of... You follow? It's a futile exercise. Did it ever bother you? Did it ever bother you? It's a central question in davening. It's a tremendous problem. You follow? You probably must have grown up with some six-year-old understanding that Hashem is some kind of, I don't know, I bought a Zohar up there, some sort of power that you can convince, you can twist his arm, you can buy him off. By doing what he wants, you buy him off, and then he gives you what you want. All nonsense. Now, let's try and understand some of the ideas behind this very difficult area and what it's got to do with the guy. Okay, now, let's just add a cherry on top. It says in the Gemara that Hashem davened. It says in the Gemara Bracha that Hashem davened. And the Gemara even says what the words of his tefillah. You know, we have a principle that Hashem does everything we do. He puts on tefillin. Someone says clearly, Hashem puts on tefillin every day. Where's tefillin? What does it say in his tefillin? There are certain tefillin. In our tefillin, it says certain things about him. In his tefillin, it says certain things about us. Our tefillin have a praise of Hashem as the one God, the one Hashem. And his tefillin have a praise, tefillin, that are praise of us as the one great nation. Right? He does exactly what we do. So then the Gemara says, and he doesn't. He says, he prays. What does he pray? First of all, I want to know who does he pray to. That's what I want to know. If I know. What does it mean he prays? The Gemara says it. So he couldn't say anything. And then the Gemara says, the Gemara doesn't say what he says. And he says a tefillah that's very similar to what we say. The Gemara says, he says the following words. When we say, Yehi Rotson Milfanecho, right? May it be your will. We'll have to discuss what this means and why we say that. And then we say, Hashem Elokai V'Elokai V'Sai, or Elokai V'Elokai V'Sai. You always have to daven in the name of the forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. May it be your will, and then we say what it is that we want him to do. When Hashem davens, he says, Yehi Rotson Milfanai, may it be my will, this is what he says, may it be my will, that I should get up and move from the Kisei Hadin to the Kisei Rachamim. That I should move myself from the throne of judgment and justice to the throne of mercy and rachamim and kindness. That's what he's feeling. That's what it means. That's the idea. So I told you it was difficult. Let's see if we can make any attempt at all to try and understand it. So now, we have the following understanding. Let's attack it from a more practical point of view. That's a Hasidic idea that puts it something like this. A very, very amazing and deep idea. Let's try and understand it something like this. Now we'll try and see it in a more essential form afterwards. Like all other Torah sugyas, we get exactly the wrong end of the thing. Like we understand exactly the wrong message, exactly the wrong thing, and that's why we have all these problems. We understand that davening is trying to change Hashem's mind. Right? Trying to change his mind. Negotiating with him, like I said before, explaining to him why it's more worthwhile for him to put up with you, or requesting why you need a new this or that or that. Right? It's negotiation in terms of trying to change. You know what you need. Oh, you don't need changing. You're fine. The question is, you lack a little bit of finance, you lack a bit of this, a bit of that, so you get up there and you're trying to explain to him that he should see things in a different light, and they want to change his mind. Now, what we tried to explain before, that's the sense of the problem is that, right? Like we said before, he knows what you need beforehand, and he's going to give it to you if you need it, and he isn't anyway. Even, but the crux of the issue is that you can't make any change in him. So like all Torah suggests, that's exactly the opposite of the correct understanding. The correct understanding is that if you stand in tefillah, you don't try and change him, you try and change you. That's the idea of davening. That's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to change his mind, you're trying to change you. How does that work? That's a real meditation. Meditation doesn't mean, like we said before, doesn't mean becoming a zombie. Sitting there with your mind switched off, right? That's not meditation. It might be relaxing, but that doesn't connect you with any higher world. Meditation means getting to the root of who you are and changing it. Right? But to the essential root, where the words and the figures and the numbers, where the pictures and where all that gets switched off. The outer mind gets switched off. As we tried to explain last week, that's what it means. To get into the core of what you are and change that. Now what's that got to do with davening? But the idea is as follows. You can't change the Kodesh Baruch Hu's mind. You can't change him. But the point is that when you stand up to daven, so you ask for certain things. It means this. You ask for certain things you lack. Why do you lack those things? Because at the point where you're holding now, you couldn't handle those things. But many things that you think are good for you are not good for you at all. They're just an example. Great wealth, for example. Many people think what they could do is great wealth. The truth is that for most people it would kill them. For most people, great wealth would be an enormous disaster. Right? Most people haven't got the spiritual metal to handle wealth. How bad is that problem? It's enormous, that problem. I'm just taking an example. You could work through all the things that we asked for, right, what they could do to you. But I'm just taking an example. David HaMelech says to Hashem, he says to him, Rish v'oysher al titaini, lechem chuki hatrifaini. Amazing passage. David HaMelech, King David, says to Hashem, Hashem, please don't give me wealth and don't give me poverty. Just give me the bread that I need. Right? Lechem chuki, like the bread that's cut out for me, exactly what I need. That means, now, King David was Melech HaMashiach, but nobody on earth was able to handle anything in life better than he was. But his filler to Hashem was, don't give me, David or Shlomo, David. He said to Hashem, give me only what I need, because I don't think that I could handle wealth, and I don't think I could handle poverty. That's too big an ordeal for me. Don't give me any ordeals, like we daven in the morning, right? Don't give me any tests. So he davened to Hashem, don't give me the test of wealth and the test of poverty. You see that they're both tremendous ordeals. I just want exactly, Rav Avram Shag, the Rebbe of Rav Yitzchak Chaim Zonnenfeld, he owned some property in Yerushalayim. An amazing story. I mean, just to show you the difference between that. He lived at the late 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, turn of the century. He came to Yerushalayim where he told me, that Yitzchak Chaim Zonnenfeld, and lived in Yerushalayim. It's a wonderful book, by the way. You should read the Art Scroll book just to get a slight feel of what that generation was. It's called The Guardian of Jerusalem. I don't think you can survive without reading it. You should definitely go read that book. Just to get a feel of what greatness, what a person's capable of. Just to get a feel of that generation. This is what happened. He owned property in Yerushalayim. Happened to be what's now called Jaffa Street. But he happened to own Jaffa Street. Okay? But before it was what it is today. At that time, it was just a stretch of land between the old city, Jaffa Gate. You're familiar with Yerushalayim a little bit. Outside Jaffa Gate is a connection that goes up to Jaffa Road. Jaffa. So he owned, Rav Avraham Shag himself owned the tract of land between the Jaffa Gate and what's the bottom end of town now. You know, the bottom end, just as the road dips off to the old city, that end, he owned that tract of land and a bit above it. And there was nothing built there at the time when he came to Yerushalayim. It was just an open, dusty area, and he owned it. During his lifetime, they started to build over there. They started to build, and it started to become, right, property that's, you know, the most valuable property imaginable. When the property started to skyrocket, they ran into him and they said to him, Rebbe, you know what's happening. The properties around yours are going for They're escalating, but they've started to skyrocket. He says, sell immediately. They said to him, what are you saying? If you wait a week or two, you'll be a millionaire. He said, that's what I'm worried about. Sell now. You know what I mean? And he sold the property before it could appreciate enough to be an ordeal for him. All he wanted was poverty. Huh? Don't understand that. That's not the way we see the world, you see. People who saw the world spiritually didn't think that way. By the way, I'm not telling you to go out and divest yourself. If you hold him by the level of I'm sure, and you can think of it, if I ask you, Now, but the point is this, that when you ask for something, it's a very fine balance whether you need that thing or you don't need it. So what you think you need isn't necessarily what you need. Not necessarily. And he gives you what you need, exactly, whether it's as a test, a difficulty, as an ordeal, or a great bounty as an ordeal. Everything in life is an ordeal. Right? So the Siddhartha Sharan says that every single thing in the world is a test for a person. Right? Every single thing in the world is a test for you. So he measures up exactly what you need and he gives it to you. Now, when you get up and you say, I need this and this, or I want this and this, you might not be right. That means you might be holding at a level where you couldn't handle that thing. And he won't give it to you. And you can't change his mind. But what you can do is you can change you. And if you change you, you could become the kind of person who could handle that thing. If your tefillah changes you from being the kind of individual who couldn't use that thing, right, safely and positively, to being the kind of person who could use that thing, so now you could get it. So he could give it to you. You follow? So he gives it to you not because he changed his mind, he changed you. You reformed yourself. In that act of meditation, you recreated who you are. So now you're the kind of person who really could use that, whatever that thing is that you're asking him for. So he could give it to you. Not because you changed. You follow? Now, the question is this, not so simple. Why do you change yourself by davening? Change yourself through mitzvah. Change yourself through acts of self-control. Why is it in davening that you change yourself? And why is it by requesting things that you change yourself? This is a very, very difficult and subtle point, but this is the core of everything we have to say. If what we're saying is correct, this Hasidic idea, that davening is changing yourself, so we have to understand now a very difficult thing. Why is it that you change yourself by requesting things? That's the problem. You hear the problem? If I'm trying to convince you, right here I am, I'm telling you that davening, the idea of being able to receive a thing that you didn't have before, is because you change yourself into the kind of person who could use that thing. Fine. But the question is this, how do you become that new person by making a request? That's what's hard to understand. Let's say you're the kind of individual who wants money, and you couldn't handle money. So go out and work on yourself so you've got more self-control and more discipline and your spiritual values are better and you can handle it and then you'll be given it. What has it got to do with davening? Now, this is where we connect with the Dao. Okay? If you were here last week, have a little understanding of what that inner wisdom is, then this will be a little easier to understand. Now, that's as follows. The act of asking means switching on what's called rotsen. Rotsen means desire. The act of asking for something means coming to want that thing. That means, now, let's try and understand this thing. When we look at the Das, like we tried to explain last week, if we want to put it in a very simple way, but which is forbidden, it's forbidden to think this way. It's only permitted to use such a scheme in order to get some understanding. But as soon as it clicks into the mind, it then has to abstract itself into a place that doesn't involve any pictures or diagrams, as we've often said before. You could picture the Das, if you were allowed to, as a line running through the human. Like we said before, it's not one of the mystical points in the body, it's the central line that connects all the points. We tried to explain it by saying that, when we discussed it last time, we said that the Das is that which runs through the tongue, right? It runs through the central organs in the body, the Brit Mila, the Brit Loshen, the two concepts of Brit in the body, which are the only male organs in the body. All other organs are females. Right? All other organs are doubled and females. Without going into detail. And that's why they're always expressed in the feminine in Hebrew. All doubled organs in Hebrew, even if the grammar doesn't require female, they're always expressed in the feminine. The only organs that are expressed in the male, one other exception which I'm not going to go into now, is the central organs in the body, because they are single, unpaired, and they're male. The tongue, the Brit Aloshim, the covenant of what's called the tongue, and the Brit Mila. Those two things. The Das, why does it run through there? Because those are the parts of the body that make connections that produce fruits in the world, like we tried to explain last time. The mouth is the place where you speak, and you create, like it really makes Talmidim, let's say. That's even more powerful than making children in the world. Difficult to go into in too much detail, but that's the function of the Das. We tried to explain it last time another way by saying that the Das is marriage. Right? It's marriage itself. It's the place where husband and wife meet. That's called knowledge. That's called knowledge. Again, difficult to go into the mixed group. By mixed, I mean people in Tapicuri. Something like that. That's called the dhyana. Now, this line, and we tried to explain it in detail before, we're not going to go through it again, but the concept we have of the dhyana is inner wisdom, and it's the wisdom that you know beyond, right, at the level where you can't put things into words. Just to give one example we didn't give last week, right, and that is that we tried to say last week that the dhyana is the place where you know that you exist. We try to say that, right? Not, you don't know you exist because you think about it. You don't know that you exist because you can work it out or because you can taste, feel, touch. You know you exist because your dhyana is alive in it. So the people who talk about this, they give a most wonderful example, which we didn't explain last week, and they say that if you want to ever experience your own dhyana, you want to experience your own knowledge that you're here. So the worst way to do it is to think about it, like we tried to explain last week. You just start thinking about it. If you really are here, you have one big doubt. But that's what happens. As soon as you sit back and try and rationalize, am I really here or not? Now, the first thing that happens, you have an enormous doubt. That's what it is. Only when the dance works do you know you're here. How do you let that flourish? When does it flower? How do you really know? When you go through an experience of abject terror. Right? When you're in absolute, abject, mortal terror, then you know you exist for sure. At that moment, you don't start... You follow? Like when the plane starts to shake very badly. You ever have any fear? At that moment, you don't... You know, what's the problem? Sit back in your seat and say, well, look, you know, last night I was sitting in my armchair trying to work out if I'm really here or not. So for the next 5 minutes, let's assume I'm not here. Right? It doesn't work as well. When you're in mortal terror, what happens is the outer mind gets completely switched off. When a person goes through that experience, the only thing you can think of, no matter what you were thinking about 5 minutes before, 5 minutes before that you could have been thinking of the most complex arrangement and where you're going and what you're going to do in life. Nothing could be more important than that. But when that experience hits you, so in that instant, all you think about is, please don't let me die, or my child. Right? A mother could think that. An extension of the same thing. But other than that, you don't have any... It's amazing how quickly your priorities change, by the way, when that starts to happen. All the arrangements that you were going to do and everything that depended on it, just a little bit of shaking of the airplane, you know, no big deal. Now, people go through that all the time. But it has to happen to you for a minute or two, and all of a sudden, the whole trip becomes irrelevant, and your whole life becomes irrelevant, except your life. That's all. That's a raw feeling, not the fear, by the way. You have to tease out the feeling. The emotion of fear is not dhyana. Dhyana is knowledge, it's not an emotion. That's why it's a little difficult, as an example. Another example, I don't know if we mentioned this last week, another example of where the dhyana works is the exact opposite. We did mention the feeling of ecstasy and how that's the feeling of dhyana, that is difficult to go into also. But they do say that the root of all ecstatic experiences is the feeling of being alive. And the time when the dhyana grasps that feeling most strongly is when you were about to not be alive, and then that changed. In that instance, you know, I once heard my Rebbe describe, when he was trying to teach this sugya, the way he explained it was, he said that when he was a little boy, he nearly drowned, and he was sucked under the waves, and he couldn't breathe. And as he was about to die, that saved him. Have you ever had that experience of being caught in an undertow? Ever happened to you at the sea? You've been sucked under the wave, and as you try and break the surface, you get pulled down more and more. That happens to you, a terrifying experience. As you're about to lose consciousness, you suddenly get a breath. That breath is a breath of pure dhyana. That experience, that first breath that you take, and you feel that you're alive, in that moment you can't sit back and rationalize about whether you exist or not either. Right? And that's a pure experience, and it's only an experience of being alive. That's all it is, by the way. Nothing good happened to you. On the contrary, you're still feeling pretty shaky. But just the fact that you're aware you're alive, if you're really aware of it, and people who train themselves spiritually are able to feel that all the time. People who reach a level, this is not exactly tonight's subject, but it's connected to the dhyana, that is, people who work on themselves spiritually are always in ecstasy. The Chazon Ish said that there is no sadness in the world for somebody who knows the true light of the Emet. That's what he said. Somebody who's mature, who understands what's called the aura of Emet, the light of truth, I know, odd words to translate, but somebody who knows what's going on, basically, who understands, somebody whose dhyana is operating, let's put it that way, is never, ever depressed. Never. Never ever depressed. Mourning is a different thing. I'm not talking about its obligation. But depression, which is a worse thing, Hasidic great who say that depression is worse than any of our in the Torah, although it's not forbidden. You will never see in the Torah thou shalt not be depressed. It doesn't say that anyway. But it's worse than any of our, because it brings you to the worst thing. Brings you to the end. Terrible. Anybody who knows what's going on, no matter what his tortures are, is never ever depressed. Ever. Because the ecstasy of just being alive is so great. Even in the most intense suffering, right? No. You don't believe that? Try having an experience where you're just about not to be. and the first few seconds after you are, right, you feel very, very positive about life, unless there's something wrong with you. So if you're a normal individual, there are people, it is possible to train away that feeling. It is possible. People can have it themselves so badly they can actually train away that feeling. That is possible. We're not talking about that. But the normal healthy gift of a human is to experience life in such a way that it's an ecstasy. If you want a simple example, I'll tell you from the medical field, you see it often, I mean, you see it relatively infrequently, unfortunately, but relatively often, considering that it's a miracle, is that you see people who are about to die, and sometimes they get saved. Sometimes it happens. There's a man there who's suffering from a terrible illness, terminal. And he goes to visit his doctor, and he's only got hours to live, let's say. And the doctor examines him and says, I can't believe that you're cured. How does that man walk home? He jumps over the trees, flies over the building, right? He's flying. What happens? What happened to you? Anything good happened? Nothing good happened. You're just alive, that's all. Maybe he's probably pretty weak still. But what's he so happy about? They're just alive, that's all. There's somebody who's about to lose it, and it says what it means. So the Bala Musa say you should wake up every morning like that. But we're not talking Musa tonight, but I've got to put it in. They say that when you wake up, you say, Modea Milafanecha. Those words break from your mouth before you even wash your hands. When you wake up in the morning, you're still out of the oven. You can't say Hashem's name. You haven't used the bathroom, and you haven't washed your hands. So you can't say Tzilis. But you can't control those words. You wake up, a lot of people didn't wake up this morning. You woke up and you've got two kidneys and two eyes and two hands. There's a lot of happiness there. Right? The Bala Musa say that you should be ecstatic at having a rectum. You know what people feel who don't have a rectum? They're very miserable. You must think a rectum is a pretty lonely thing. If you ask any doctor who knows people who don't have one, they give anything for it. Right? And you woke up this morning with all those things. That's the words break from your mouth. Say, well, down here, thank you, Hashem, waking me up. That's what you're supposed to say. But that's the feeling that the diocese, look, it's easy to talk yourself. The trouble is, we're so trained to look at the world, you know, like the world owes me a living. So, like, now, is today going to be good or bad? Like, I'm here neutral. So, now, is today going to be good or it's going to be bad? That's how it is. But that's the Jews not supposed to look at the world that way. Neutral is the way most of the universe was before you ever thought of, and the way it'll be after you're not thought of again. That's neutral. So, the little brief flash of an instant that you hear, that's very unusual, that goes in a flash. So, for that little brief instant that you hear, they should be ecstatic about it. You don't know when it's going to end, and it ends very quickly. And as you go through it, the older you get, the more you feel that everything that's been like as a flesh, it's nothing. Where's your life? Where's your past? Where's your past right now? What do you have of it? A little bit of electrochemical stuff in the brain that's called a memory, that's all. It's frightening. So you're not going to get excited about it now. So when are you going to get excited? Only get one chance. Anyway. Tonight's not, Monday night is mysticism night, it's not Muslim night, so we'll... So leave it. But that's the idea. Now, the diet is the tool that feels that happiness. Right? It's the diet that feels that a healthy diet is always happy. Because of God. Now, that's what we said last week. We tried to expand on this and explain it in many different ways. We can't do it again. Now, let's take a new area that we didn't explain before. And that's this. When you travel in the diet, you can go up inside the diet. You can go up to higher places. You can have a knowledge of your own existence, but you can have something higher than that. Emunah, for example, as we said last week, is a higher function. What's the root of the dark? What's the place at the top of this line, somewhere in the top of the human, where it's filling all, where the baby's head is open, right, where it's connected to the higher world? What's up there? So the thing that's up there is called desire. The root of the dark is called what? It's called desire. Will or desire? Just try and understand that. And when you're davening, that's what you're working on. When you're davening, the experience of davening is a meditation that takes you up in the dark to the point where you're experiencing your own desire as it becomes your desire. When you experience what you want, as it becomes what you want, and you can reform what you want. You can change what it is that you want. And what you want is what you are. Because after you want the thing, then you're just a machine that sets about getting what you want, but it's just running on automatic from there on in. The only place you really change who you are is when you change what you want in life. Then everything's different after that. If you want this or you want that. So if you want this, then everything automatically goes in that direction. If you want the other thing, so then you go in that direction, but it's all automatic. The only place you make a difference is in what you want. That's why the highest crowning glory of a human is Bechira. The Rishonim say that free will is the element of the fact that we created in Hashem's image is the fact that we have free will. You know that. How do we look like Hashem? How do we look like God? He doesn't have two hands like we have. But what do we look like in? So the Rishonim all say the fact that we look like him means that just like he's free to choose to do what he wants, we are free to do what we want. Nothing else in the universe is free like that. No atom is free to choose how it spins. No planet is free. No biological creature is free. Right? All animals act out only their instincts. They're not free at all. The only point of freedom in the universe besides the creator is a human. That's all. he can really make a difference. He can go this way or that way, and no one forces him. Not only does no one force him, but when you choose this way, they send down, the whole spiritual world starts to organize you in that direction. All you do is make a rough swing in a certain direction. That's what I say. The road that you want to go, the whole of the spiritual cosmic reality opens up and it sweeps you along in that direction. All you have to do is want it. That's how powerfully aim, dover, omer, bifnei rasa. Nothing stands in the way of desire. Chazal aren't given to exaggeration. There's no exaggeration in Torah, right? There's never an exaggeration. What about any exaggeration anywhere? And it says this, ein davar oimed bifnei ha'rotzon. Nothing stands in the way of desire. Again, nothing stands in the way of desire. That means it literally. If you want something, nothing stands in the way of what you want. Nothing. Ein davar. Nothing stands in the way of what you want. That's an amazing statement. All you have to do is want it. You really have to want it. You have to change it in the rotzon. Right? You know, you can't fool yourself into a new permutation of the same old miserable lower drive. That's not called rotzon. You've got to go up and revise the source. Nobody said it's easy. I didn't tell you it's easy. But if you change what's called rotzon, that's the beginning of the dust, everything flows out from the automatic, from above and below, everything opens up. Right? That's what it says. Now, that's how powerful it is. Now let's try and understand more deeply. Why is what you want the cause? So, you see, let's start like this. We said that we always look at the words. The word ratzon. The word ratzon in Hebrew. Ratzon. That's an amazing word. First of all, the root of it is ratz, which means to run. Because it's the source of all movement. That's what the Mephoshim say. At that point is where all motion begins. You follow? Before that point is called ayin, nothingness. It's the completely hidden world. Yesh me'ayin. It's something that comes from nothing. Right? It's hidden completely. So the first thing that could be, that anything moves from, where the beginning of anything is a moot. You know, the whole world in Hebrew is called running. You know that? In Hebrew, the whole world is called running. Eretz. Eretz. Al Shem Hadritza. Eretz means the land, the world. And the root of the word is running. Because the world is all moving towards the tachlis, towards the purpose. The next world, which is called heaven, in English it's all nonsense, the word heaven. You follow, in English it's ridiculous about a sky. Nobody's trying to ponder what the sky is, will ever get any spiritual elevation at all. You follow? You're lost. But in Hebrew, Shamayim, which means the heavens, it's mistranslated as English as the heavens, Shamayim really means Shamim. If you write the word Shamayim in Hebrew, it's spelled Sham. Shamim means there. That is anything that you can say there. Not on its way to, but when you get there. The next world is when you arrive. This world is going someplace. The next world is when you're there. That's what Shabbat is. That's why we train ourselves every week in an experience of having arrived. What's the essence of Shabbat? That you don't go any place. You don't build or make or create. Why? Because you come from some non-Jewish sect or some perverted Jewish sect, then you understand it's a day of rest. But that's a perversion. It's not a day of rest. It's a day of tachlis. It's a day where you don't do anything because you've done it or you experience its being now instead of... Again, you follow. The week is making. Shabbat is having arrived. Why? Because it's a training for the big Shabbat. The big Shabbat is a big Shabbat after a big long week. And the week is building, 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 running, until you get to what's called Sham. There. No accident that the word Sham is also Shem, which means a name. Because in Hebrew, a name is always the essence of the thing. That means you arrive at the essence, you arrive at the end point, the tachlis, and the name of the thing. That's always what the next world is. You follow? That's why a name is so significant in Hebrew. That's why your name comes to you from a higher world. A person's name is very, very significant, as we said before. Now, that is the concept of what's called movement and arrival. The place of what's called arriving, Shamim, Shamayim, is called Ayin, it's hidden. Ayin, it's not. Ayin doesn't mean it's not, it just means it's hidden. You don't see it now. In Hebrew, Ayin doesn't mean it's not. Efes means it isn't. Ayin means it is, but it's hidden. Yesh me'ayin means something that gets revealed from something that's hidden. Which means that the Ratzon is the first awareness in the mind of anything after the stage where it's completely hidden. Above you, if you like. Again, these are borrowed, very crude words. But above you is a place that's not revealed to you. Comes into the mind something that is now with you. Of course, as soon as it comes in, it's too late, because it's there already. We're talking about when it's coming in. You have to grasp it at the moment when it's being created. If you have it when it's already in your mind, it's too late already. It's there. It's part of you. It's part of the finite. It's too late. Yesh me'ayin means the process of something becoming from nothing. Okay? It's only in that incredible, infinite, transcendent transition from nothing. In the transition from nothing to something in the mind, that flesh, that's what you really are. And it's that part of the mind that makes free will decisions. When you choose something and you go for one thing or for another thing,
in that moment you are experiencing the highest level of Das. You follow? You're experiencing because you're recreating, and you're literally recreating yourself. When you choose what you're going to do next year, you can either do one thing next year or you can do another thing. One path is a normal kind of path in the world. One path is ideological, idealistic. It's going to build you in the world. What could be more important than that? Your life is your time. What you're going to spend the next year doing, that decision, is an enormous decision. When a youngster gets out of school or goes to university or starts, whatever he does, that decision about, the truth is that every day is like that. The truth is that every day, when you wake up in the morning and what you take on to do that day, or how you're going to do what you do, and every minute is that way, really. But you can feel it more easily if you take a big decision. That creates who you are. And it's all based on the decision. From there on in, it's just, the mystics say that it's like an impulse in the brain. If you want a crude analogy, when the brain fires, then what happens is after that impulse fires, it goes to certain nuclei, certain nerve channels, down certain nerves, and a certain muscle twitches. That's what happens. But the whole thing is only meaningful where the impulse flashes in the brain. The rest is just automatic. Once that impulse has been fired in the brain, it just runs down wires. The fact that it's at this part of the wire, or that part of the wire, or the muscle is actually twitching, is not different from a monkey. No different from an atom spinning. Yet it does not have any intrinsic meaning. But what it means is just a revelation in the world of what you wanted in the world. Is that correct? And you can feel it in a gross way. If you see somebody who does something that's kind, let's say somebody does something generous, they give you something that you need. Anybody with any intelligence, somebody who's completely insensitive just looks at the object. Now that's not a human action, like a dog. Give a dog a bone, the dog doesn't start becoming all metaphysical about you and your desire to give and so forth. The dog just sees the bone, he eats the bone. So most of us function that way. When somebody gives you love, even the most intimate and deepest aspects of love, most of us just look at the crudest level imaginable. That's how we train. That's how this generation is. That's what we fall into. But anybody with any sensitivity knows that when you get that end organ thing, that twitch of a muscle, right, what you relate to is what happened inside the person. When somebody gives you something that you need and you feel a glow, right, an appreciation, a warmth, a love for that person, you're not loving the fact that the muscle twitched or the fact that the nerve conducted an impulse. That's irrelevant, you follow? Even though you never could have experienced it unless the nerve did its job and the muscle did its job. You never could have experienced it. They never would have given you that thing that you needed. Or the muscles of their mouth moved to say the kind words that you needed to hear. What really means something to you is the rotzin, the desire that they had, the core of their being that was being expressed in that thing. I mean, it's obvious this. It's just embarrassing that we have to talk about these things that are so obvious. But all we use the world for is just a revelation of what its internality is. You realize the wickedness of this generation, that we take the whole world, and instead of seeing it as an expression of a core, we just look at the world. We don't bother to think further. You follow? The world is just muscles twitching. That's what the mystics say that. The world is just bits and pieces of wood and stone. This isn't anything more than that. You follow? Just like a human hand, no different from a monkey's hand. No different at all. That monkey peels a banana. It's no different at all than a human hand giving you an arm. Nothing, no different than a tissue, muscle, blood, bone, just like a monkey. But the point is it reveals a hidden depth, and that's what's meaningful to you in the world. So when you look at the world, this generation been trying to look at the world and stop there. Well, instead of taking everything back to its hidden source. But it's such an obvious example. When you look at a person, the source is hidden, and that's only what you want. When you look at the world, we're not prepared to think about any hidden sources. That's too mystical and metaphysical for me. I'll stick with a banana. Now, so again, what are we trying to do? We're trying to see everything as a revelation of an inner depth called the Das. And everything in the Das is a revelation of its core and its point of creation, which is called Rotson. So that's why Rotson means the beginning of movement. Okay? Now, Rotson also, the number, if you add up the words, you know that in Hebrew there's a thing called Gematria. Any word in Hebrew that adds up to a number, any other word in Torah that adds up to the same number has an intrinsic connection in meaning between it. You know that's called Gematria, right? There's no accident. Anybody thinks Hebrew or Torah is like an accident, you've got to have your head read. Because you follow, you can take any word and it means exactly the same thing as any other word that adds an incredible thing. The word for Echad in Hebrew, which means one, adds up to 13 if you add the numbers up. It's a secret in its own right. The word for Ahava, love, also adds up to 13 because it means a becoming one. You follow? So now, over and over and over. Now, the word Rotzon in Hebrew adds up to the same value as Shmoy, which means Hashem's name. It also adds up to the same value as Makor. Makor means the source. That's an amazing thing. So again, Rotzon, desire, the beginning of any process in Hashem's mind, whatever that means, and in the human mind, that adds up, Rotzon, desire, equals the beginning of anything, equals Hashem's name, which is the core of existence, and equals Makor, which means a root, a source. The womb, by the way, is called Makor. The root, the womb is called the Makor, the root, the source. and it's on the same central line as we tried to explain before. But I can think about these things as they say. Very, very amazing. Now, that's what the Ratzon is. So, let's look at it, let's step back and look at it again. When a person experiences a will, a desire, not a desire that comes from below the belt, right, or from the chest, which is called the emotional level, the physical drives and the emotional drive. We're not talking about that. That doesn't come from the Ratzon. That comes from the steamy lower self. That then filters up into the mind and tries to fool you that that's what you really want. We're not talking about that. You follow? Animal has that too. That's not called human Ratzon. It's got nothing to do with the das. You with me? Like we said before, when a cat decides that it wants to jump from this trash can to the other trash can, that's also making a decision. That's also acting out desire. You follow? If you spoke to that cat, he'd tell you very convincingly that he really wanted to do that thing and he desired it. But it's not called Ratzon. But we're talking about das over there. Because we're talking about a human thing where the das, the yesh me'ayin, we're talking when you recreate something new that wasn't there before. That's what it means to be human. And of course, most people never experience that ever. Most people alive in the world today never even vaguely begin, right, to originate any Ratzon that comes from a level that's beyond them. But that's what it means to be human. What we're saying is that 99.99% of the people alive on the earth today are living like a cat jumping from one trash can to another. This doesn't take any proving. If you go out there and see what people are doing out there, nobody ever raises themselves in meditation to a thing called Ratzon and try to reform who they are. They think you're bananas if you speak to them like that. You follow? They don't, generation doesn't count, that sort of thing. But that's what it means to be human, that's what it means to be Jewish, and that's what spiritual existence is. Now we can put it together a little bit. So when you change your Ratzon, you're changing yourself. And that's why davening is an experience of requesting. What you're trying to do, you're asking, you're wanting, that's what you're doing. The meditation of davening is an exercise where you train yourself to want a new existence. You follow? That's why the form of changing yourself in Jewish life is to ask for something new. What you're trying to do is raise yourself in your inner das to a level where you actually want that new thing and you experience the raw power of feeling the desire for that thing. If you get there, it'll definitely happen. It's a promise. It says that all the worlds are opened up if you want the thing. The higher worlds, the lower worlds, everything is organized. All you have to do is really want it. And of course, that's why the first thing you ask for is das. The first thing that you want, the first davening, the first thing you ask for, first the first three brokers, like we said, you say. But the first request is koinana das. You ask Hashem to give you das. Some people modify that. There are some people who daven. You hear this well. There are some people who are honest with themselves. And they know that they don't really want those things. Who really wants spiritual greatness? Who really wants spiritual greatness? Not many people. But most people really want is what comes from a very, very low level of their lives. Right? So those who are honest, they don't ask Hashem for spiritual greatness and for das. They ask Him to help them want it. You follow? They daven for the Ratzon. There are people who do that. There are people who have a special tefillah at the end of the Shemoneh Esrei. That they ask Hashem, they say, listen Hashem, I'm honest. I don't really want what you want. Let's face it, I want to be an animal. That's what I really want. I'd be happy to be a happy animal. As long as you don't hurt me too bad, and you give me what I need, and you keep me happy every day, I would be happy. Let's face it, man. So Hashem, but I know I shouldn't be that way. I know I should want what you want. I know I should want what you want me to want. I know I should want spiritual greatness. I should want to work on myself and raise myself through difficulty. I know I should want that, but let's face it, I don't want that. So Hashem, please make, I really want to want that. That I do want. That I do want. Some people are very low, they ask to want that. But it's, you need a lot of Gemara training to be able to. But people do ask for that. And you'll be given it. If you ask for the Ratzon that you should really desire, crave to become great spiritually, then you'll be given that desire. And once you have the desire, definitely do it. But at some level, you have to plug into the Ratzon. You have to go. Okay, so what we try to explain in summary is this. That the form of davening, the way we understand that we meditate, that we go to the root, is that we try and change what it is that we want. We try and change the core of what we are. How do we do that? By going to our core. The core of what we are is what we actually want at root, right? As a new desire. We try and change that. When you change that, you become a new individual. But it means the person has to change his whole outlook on life. Davening is just the time when you focus on it. But your whole life has to be focused on trying to become something new. On trying to build yourself into something new. You have to really want that. Not just to amble along with the lower happinesses in life and occasionally an amount of. And that's why, that brings us to the second area, which is why the davening is such an essential part of human life, of Jewish life. We grasp that davening is something you do when you're in extremes. right? When things are going bad, when you have trouble. That's the time when you pour out your heart and you ask for something. That's not the right understanding of davening. There's a special halacha that's a mitzvah d'oraisa to daven when you're in crisis. Right? It's a special mitzvah. It says in the Torah that when an enemy comes against you, and then you have to daven and Hashem will save you. Then you blow the trumpets and you daven, that's all it says. And the Rishonim learned that it's a mitzvah. So they say that when a person, but suddenly, when you are in the straits, when you are in a time of crisis and things are being, you're being squeezed badly, then it's a mitzvah to daven and to ask for, to be helped and to be saved, and that's what it is. But there's another aspect to davening, which is that it's not only when things are bad. There's a halacha of davening that just to carry on existing you need to daven. Not only in a crisis. That's a special kind of tefillah when you're in crisis, to ask for help. But just to stay alive, you need davening, right? You need to make that connection in the first place that keeps you alive. To make a connection between the higher world and this world, right? Just to make that connection at any moment when you're not in crisis, never mind helping difficulties, that's a halacha that a Jew has to do. And that is what's called the malchus. Malchus means the revelation of kingship. The revelation of Hashem being a king. That we've, up to now we've discussed these things before, either a year ago or 6 months ago. What we haven't discussed before is this aspect of it. And for those who have been for a while, try and always put in something new. This is an area we didn't discuss before, and that is that there's an aspect in davening which is called revelation of the malchus of Hashem. Okay? Let's try and understand this for a while and try and answer some of the questions we began with for the next few minutes. The concept of davening is called Amida Lifnei HaMelech. Right? That's called, a person has to daven as if he's standing in front of the king. Right? It's called the Avda Kamei Mare. Like an Eved in front of his master, like a slave in front of his master. That's how you have to daven. Right? For existence. For existence. Not only you have to daven as a request, you have to ask for existence, like we've tried to discuss up to now what requests mean, but the act of standing in front of Hashem gives you the merit to continue existing. And if you don't do that, you don't exist. If you don't daven for rain, it will not rain. Right? We'll try and explain this, all what it means. First of all, let's just understand the background from a deeper point of view, is that asking, standing in front of Hashem, is giving rise to the existence of what's called Malchus. Now, Malchus means the fact that there's a king and he has subjects. The mystical concept, we're not going to go into this in detail, but the mystical concept of the existence of the world is based on the tenth of all ten mystical, if you like, the shoe that holds all of them, the shoe in which the body stands, the bottom level that holds everything, the ultimate woman, that the mystics call the ultimate female level, the woman of the world, is called Malchus. That's the place where the world is revealed. That's the body, the kli, the vessel that holds all the spiritual existence, right? That thing called Malchus is made by davening. In case you think that davening is just an experience where you ask for things that you want, like we said up to now, even reforming yourself, it's much, much more than that. It's a revelation of Hashem's presence in the world. How does it work? We don't have to, certainly won't be able to explain this fully, if it's even possible to do such a thing. But a few ideas that bring it out are this. You know, the Malchus is a concept that it doesn't have anything of its own. Kingship, and Malchus, not English word for it, but what's called Malchus is always what's called Leis Lame de Garmei Klum. It has nothing of its own. It's a complete empty thing that has nothing of its own. It's only a receiver. That's why it's the ultimate woman. She doesn't have anything of her own. She only receives from her husband. Then, of course, she gives life. She gives life, which a man can't do. But she starts by receiving, right? The ultimate. The Malchus only is able to receive. And that's why a person has to stand like a slave, like an Eved. You know, the halachas in davening, you're supposed to dress. When you daven, you're supposed to be dressed as you would appear before a king. You're not supposed to be sloppy. You're supposed to be standing in front of the king. You have to stand in trembling. You have to stand, it's an incredible thing. The effort, the emotional effort of davening, is that a person has to stand in abject terror and in ecstasy at the same time. Right? Gilu bir odot says, you have to rejoice in trembling. Why do you have to rejoice in trembling? How do you put these two emotions together? Because hinging on this experience is your life. So you're in great anxiety because life depends on this, but in great ecstasy because here's your chance. Right? The Mephoshim give a crude analogy. They say it's like a man who has to go begging, and he goes to a rich man's door. And this man has the power to give him life or to end his life. Right? His whole life is in the hands of this man. He's going to give him what he needs, he'll live. If he won't, he won't. How does he feel as the door starts to open? He knocks on the door and he stands outside. As he stands on the doorway, on the doorstep, how does he feel as the door starts to open? He feels two conflicting emotions at the same time. He feels abject terror to face this individual in whose hands his life is. But he feels ecstasy. Here's the opportunity. If the door's opening, now you could ask. You could ask for what you want. Now that's an incredible. So you mix, in case you think it's impossible to mix two emotions, but you have those two emotions together. That's the experience of davening. But the essence of the feeling that a person has to have, the emotion that he has to have when he davens, is that existence depends on this experience. Not only that existence depends because I'm asking for it, but the very fact that I stand in front of Hashem, right, existence depends on that. It's the connection between the higher and the lower worlds. What does it mean, the connection between the higher and the lower worlds? The Mephoshim say something like this, that if you stand in front of Hashem when you daven, that means He stands in front of you. No less than that. We have an understanding that every tefillah is listened to. Everything you say outside Israel is much harder. Inside Eretz Israel, you're heard directly. Outside of Eretz Israel, you have to go through certain channels. It's better to daven in Hebrew. There's certain levels that has to get through. That's a very complicated. I'm not going into that now. Maybe some other time. It's us better to daven in Hebrew, and if you can't daven in Hebrew, you should try daven with a minyan, because any language gets through then when you're with a minyan. If you can't do that, you daven in English, it's okay. But at certain levels, when you're in Israel, right, in that place where the connection is direct, it's a whole different level. Let's not get into that now. But the point is that you're making a direct connection. It says, Hashem tilcha al yad yaminecha, Hashem is your shadow on your right hand, what you do, He does. So if you stand and face Him in tefillah, He stands and faces you. Literally 100%. And that's why you stand and say, the body has to be clean. Before you daven, you have to check that your body's clean. Right? Your body has to be clean when you daven. Your mouth has to be completely empty, that your mouth is, you have to be, there are many, many things that are very, very important. If you have a hat, you should wear a hat. Whether you should wear a hat or not, another question, not tonight's subject. But if you do, certainly you should do it then. Right? You should dress in such a way that you would show the maximum respect. That's how you stand in tefillah. And that makes the connection from the melech, from the king, to the son. It says a most amazing statement, Ein melech v'loy am, there's no king without subjects. That means, kiveyochel, he can't be a king unless we allow him to be. Frightening idea. That means he can't be what? Frightening thing. The Gemara says, Atem edai v'ani keil. Amazing thing. The Pasuk says, you are my witnesses and I am Hashem. So the Mephoshim say, the Gemara says this, if you are my witnesses, I am God. And if you aren't, we can't complete those words, but the Gemara does. Frightening idea. That means that His manifestation as what He is in the world is dependent on what we do. If we give Him a chance to be in the world, if we let it come down, that connection, the connection is here. If we push it away, it disappears. And what happens to a human after he breaks that connection? You know what happens to a human who breaks that connection? You become part of the world. That's the worst din a person could ever have. You become subject to the forces that operate in the world. You get hit by a bus, because a bus coming towards you, you get hit by a bus. It's all up to accident. The way this generation perceives its hashkocha, the way this generation perceives that the world deals with him, if a microbe hits you, it hits you. If it misses you, it misses you. 100% right. There's no hashkocha higher than that. If you put yourself into the world as a person without the connection, you have no connection. And you become a biological creature like any biological creature in the world. And if you happen to get slammed by something, you get slammed. If you happen to miss it, you miss it. And you keep rolling on until something hits you. That's on Yom Kippur, the worst din that a person could ever conceive is the din of no din at all. Much better to get punishment. Much better to get a heavy hand of punishment that's leading you someplace than if Hashem says, you don't want me, I don't want you, off you go on your own. That's the greatest terror of all terrors, because then you become a biological creature made of very, very fragile and frail tissue at the mercy of a world that's got lots of agencies of destruction. That's the worst thing. Nothing could be worse than that. So desperately what a person needs to do, desperately what a person needs, is to hang on to that connection. Because that's what spiritual life is. At least the connection, apart from the request for life, just the fact to stand in tefillah, even if you don't say anything, just the amida lifnei amelech, just the standing there, lifts a person to a human level. That's what we understand. So you see what an embarrassment and a disgrace it is that you stand up 3 times a day and vomit out the same words without meaning them. You're taking the connection, the highest connection. That's a person taking the love of his husband or wife, the greatest love in the world, and just, you follow, taking it for, that's what it is. That it's a tremendous experience. A place, a beautiful place, just the last comment I want to make on this level, is a beautiful place where you see this idea, is the fact that the whole of human existence was Adam Arishon. Adam. Adam was created as the whole totality of human existence, right? You know that out of him was supposed to come nobody. He was supposed to be the perfect human level. He and Chava were supposed to go into Shabbos, and there were supposed to be no children, according to certain... They were supposed to go into Gan Eden, and that was it. But because he failed... So he was split into millions of individuals, which is what we are, each doing a little piece of the job that he was supposed to do. But he was the totality of existence, and he was supposed to live 1,000 years. He was supposed to live forever, but at a certain stage of what happened to him, after he was did what he did, he was given 1,000 years of life. What did he do with these 1,000 years of life? He gave the last 70 years. You know how long Adam Arishon lived? 930 years. What happened to the last 70 years of his life? He gave it to David HaMelech. King David lived for 70 years exactly. Where did King David's 70 years come from? It was given to him by Adam Arishon. That's what it says in Chazal. Adam had 1,000 years. He saw that King David had nothing. He saw that in the future there was a man called the Melech HaMashiach, and he had nothing. So he gave him 70 years of life. So what it means, that the Malchus, David, King David, which is kingship, royalty, Malchus, the appearance of Hashem in the world, the place where Hashem appears in the world, the great singer of Israel, because music is when the total reality appears in the world. The great King David, the Melech HaMashiach, could only be in the world because the core of human existence, which is Adam HaRishon, gave him years to live. And how does David call himself? David HaMelech, this man who lives without anything of his own. He lives only on the power that was given to him by the core of human existence. How did he define himself? He says, Va'ani Tfilah, and I am Tfilah. Isn't that an amazing thing? When David defines who he is, he could have said he's anybody. He could have said, I'm a king, I'm a singer. Na'im's Mirais Israel, the great sweet singer of Israel. He could have called himself anything, right? He said, Vahem Yistanuli, I think, Va'ani Tfilah. And I am Tfilah, I am davening, I am prayer. That's what he called himself. Not I pray, or I know how to daven, or I'm better than it. I am Tfilah. That's all I am. That's everything that I am is Tfilah. That means the Malchus, you have to have a very, very deep idea, very, very, very deep idea, that the Malchus, the place where the king is revealed, the Mashiach, the final revelation on earth, that's called Tfilah. So again, in case you think you're standing up there and spitting out some words that are meaningless, or that you're asking for a new shaitel, or whatever it is that you're doing over there, right? That's all incidental to what Tfilah is. Tfilah is the core of being alive. Finally, you see this in the rain. The rain is the thing that isn't just water. Rain is the thing that keeps the world alive. And that's why, without rain, there's no life. First of all, without water, to understand what water is. But the rain is water that comes from a hidden place. The cycle of how the rain falls is completely ununderstood. Everything else works like a clock in nature. Everything else works exactly as it has to work, and the rain is completely unpredictable. And that's why it says in Chazal that there are only three things that Hashem does himself. Everything else he leaves to an agency that works it like clockwork. But there are three things in the world that he doesn't leave to any agency. He does it, bichvoido iva atzmo. He himself does it in the world. What are they? He opens the womb, and it shouldn't need any explanation after what we discussed tonight. When a woman goes into labor, when a woman experiences labor and the womb opens, she's experiencing the hand of Hashem himself opening the womb. That's an you speak to women who've been through that experience. Speak to women who've been through that. Not those who've been so anesthetized they were completely, yes, unconscious of the experience. I'm not saying you shouldn't be anesthetized. There's no mitzvah to suffer. I'm not saying that. But a woman who was in connection with the experience, the pain, the suffering, and even if she was anesthetized, but the experience of giving birth, speak to a woman who's been through that, she'll tell you there's no way to describe that experience. For all its difficulty and all its pain, and all this danger, there's no way. Don't take it from me. Speak to women who've been through it. You'll see. That's the one thing that... The second thing that Hashem does himself is he opens the grave. When the dead are resurrected, that'll be a time when a man will also be able to feel that. And by the way, the womb is called a kever. You know that. The grave in Hebrew is called kever. And a woman's womb is called a kever. That's a very, very interesting thing. Those two graves Hashem opens himself. Because the grave is not a source of death, it's a source of life. He opens them. And the third thing that Hashem does himself, he makes the rainfall. He himself makes the rainfall. And that's why it says that the rain will never fall without davening. The rain only comes completely unpredictably. It always remains keyed in to a human request. The place we see this is that when the world was created, it says that when Adam HaRishon, you know, we all got the wrong idea. You were brought up when you were 6, understanding the days of creation. You thought that Adam was created on a Friday, and he was born in Gan Eden. That's how you think, right? And he was born into this amazing, luxuriant garden. He saw all these amazing exotic plants. That's not what Chazal said. When Adam HaRishon was born, he saw only sand. Because what happened on the fifth day, on the day of creation when the plants and flowers were created, it says that the seeds were in the ground and they all grew to the level of the ground. But none of them broke the surface. None of the seeds broke surface at all. Why? Because it says there was no rain. Why? Ki ayin Adam ayin lavod et ha'adama. There was no man to work the land. What avodah? Davening, tefillah. Since there was no human to daven for rain, there was no rain. And since there was no rain, nothing grew. So Adam HaRishon woke up, he was created, he looked around and he saw that nothing grew in the world. So he understood that he had a daven, he davened for rain, the rain fell and the Gan Eden grew. And the world was revealed as it was. So you see that without tefillah, without asking for it, there would have been nothing. And that's why the rain is always the symbol of what we said before, the Malchus, the connection between the higher and the lower world. And that's why the word Geshem in Hebrew doesn't only mean rain, it means all of physical existence, because it's all. And that's why the rain is a connection between the higher and the lower worlds. And to bring down that connection takes tefillah. If you don't ask for it, it definitely won't happen. So, we understand this, that the world is built in such a way that to bring down what's called shefa, to make the connection between the higher and the lower worlds, right? You have to request, you have to put in, you have to do that work, what's called avodah shebalev, the work that's in the heart. And this we can use to explain the final thing is what we started with in the beginning. How come the word tefillah has got two opposite meanings? How come it means asking for kind for mercy more than what, and how come it means you're just due exactly? So that's exactly what it means. The world is set up in such a way that it's designed that way. It has to be. You have to ask and you have to be given. But if you don't ask, it won't be given. In other words, you follow. It works in such a way that everything is built in the world that the channels are there and they have to be those channels. Now, it's set up like the rest of nature, like all nature is. The channels are there and they have to be activated that way. Right? It's a law of nature, it's din. But if you don't ask for it, it won't happen. That means although it's set up and designed that way, but it was made subject to human request. And so it has both those things. It has that before you ask for it, it won't happen. You have to ask to bring it down. Boy, Rahmeh. You have to bring down Rahmeh. But after you ask, it's revealed that that's the way it was supposed to be. You find it couldn't have been any other way. But we stand at the key. We stand at the fulcrum between, right, what has to be and what won't be. And we have to bring it down by asking. The Poshim say that every aspect of life is like this. Not only the rain. The rain is just the one simon of it in the world. But every aspect of existence, the fact that you're alive, it's only brought down by the fact that you bring it down yourself. And they say that every aspect of human life always has a key where you are allowed to see plainly that it depends on a higher, on Ashkocha. And I'll just give you one example and we'll close with this. They say that the Chazon Ish said that somebody once came to him with a cure for a terrible illness. Somebody once had a brainwave. And he had a potential cure, whether it was genuine or not, or a mistake, or a research error, I don't know. But somebody once came to the Chazon Ish and expressed to him the fact that he felt he had made a breakthrough that would cure the world's most difficult group of illnesses. Not everybody knows what I mean. The Chazon Ish wasn't so happy about it. He wasn't so happy about it. And they say that he said that if you correct and this cure works, Hashem will come up with another illness that will be cured, even worse. Because there always has to be one place where the key has to be held beyond human reach. In every field, there always has to be. And it's an amazing thing, that particular illness, there's been many years of research now, that particular group of illnesses, money's no problem. You know that all over the world, in the best brains, in medical and scientific circles in the world, have been working for years and years and years on this problem, on this particular group of illnesses, but with the funds at their disposal without any limit, and they haven't moved one step, not one step fundamentally, in getting to the bottom of what this problem is. They've got lots of knowledge, lots of peripheral knowledge, there are a lot of ways of managing, so, but a basic step forward in understanding what's going on, they haven't made at all. Chazon Ish was saying that every area always has to be that you have to turn to a different source. In every aspect of life, and if you don't acknowledge it, you're going to be squeezed into it. That at every turn, there's going to be a way that the world looks like it's natural, but if you get into that too deeply, there's going to be a place where you're going to be squeezed to see that the Ashkocha comes from some other place. Medicine, the rainfall, whatever it is, that a person's going to be shown up. These are some of the ideas behind the concept of tefillah.